The title of this session is The Four Zoas, William Blake's Vision of Ecclesiastes, and I'm Marvin Landsverk, and this is the last in a series I've been doing entitled Seeing Wisdom, Hearing Wisdom, Speaking Wisdom, William Blake in the Bible. So, you all have a copy of this Four Zoas thing. What I want to do today, since we're a small group, let me just flash on one picture and play a song that's Greg Brown singing this song. And you know who Greg Brown is? He's an Iowa folk singer. He took Blake's songs, Vincent's an Experience, that he wrote into the 18th century, and he performed them. And Blake sang them himself, so it's a real good fit. So just to put us in the mood.
Although there's no record of how Blake sang them, and so Greg Brown did his own.
This is a happy song of a happy poem. Since we're talking about weird stuff, it's not very happy. I thought it would be a nice place.
Sun does rise in the heavenly sky.
He said, this will all work very well here and it'll make the plant work better, but don't try this at home. And when he wrapped up, one of the people came up and asked him, well, what do you mean don't try it at home? He says, well, I'll tell you, when I was early in my career, just out of graduate school, my wife always makes me breakfast, and I was sitting there, she's making my breakfast, and I was taking a few notes. When she got done making my breakfast, I gave her some suggestions. Mm-hmm. She said, you could speed up this process a lot if you made fewer trips back and forth to the fridge, the stove, this and that, carried more things at once. And the inquirer said, well, those are all good principles, same thing you're telling us, didn't it work? And he said, yeah, well, in a manner of speaking, it did work. He said, my wife used to be able to cook my breakfast in 20 minutes. Now, I cook my own in 15.
I believe it.
And the what I put up on the board on my notes for this session is related to that just in one way. I mean, don't try this at home. And I put on the notes for the board to do try this at home. I don't know if you even saw that. But what Blake, the reason I'm finishing this week out with this work, even though it's strange and difficult, I mean, it points to that message over and over again that he's constantly saying to people, try this yourself. Do try this at home. And it even deserves a warning in front of him. If you do try what Blake is asking you to do, which in simple terms would be use your imagination, things will happen, and things perhaps unexpected. And the thing that happens in this long poem that we're taking a peek at today is you can initiate the apocalypse. You can initiate what the summer theme of Holden is. That is, and we're talking about all summer, a foretaste of the feast to come. How in this world and in the biblical vision and in many places we are getting a foretaste of that big final feast, which will come in the end. And in Blake's view, as many others, that isn't just something that will happen long in the future, but it's something that is happening around us right now. If you do try some of these things at home, and some of those things are what I want to take a quick peek at in here. What I'm going to do today, I guess, is just say a couple quick things, show and tell about this poem, and then just do some reading in it, some of the beautiful parts and unusual parts, and then get back to Blake's simpler vision of the very same thing, which is where we started with. The way Blake worked was increasingly his works got longer and longer and more complicated, but they were really saying the same thing over and over again in different ways. So if you're trying to just to sit down and say, well, who is William Blake, this visionary poet, artist? I've heard a few things about him, but what is he? Looking at this might not be the best introduction to Blake because this stuff is strange. But then everything he does is strange. And in that respect, looking at something like this isn't a bad introduction at all to Blake, because what he's doing here is the same thing that he's doing over and over and over again. It's at the heart of sort of his vision, and he views it as the heart of Jesus' vision and a mission.
But it may be the same thing he's doing over and over and over again, except for he does it in more reachable terms when he writes some of his poetry. It's more understandable.
Yeah, I mean, just sheer length alone.
Now, you've said that he wanted people to understand this God.
Yes.
It wasn't this God of judgment that everybody was seeing. And he didn't like what he saw going on in London. It was dreadful what was happening to people.
Right.
Well, he's writing all these things because he really cares. But nobody's paying much attention to him. It doesn't matter.
Well, he as an artist, he wanted to be appreciated, and he complained about that nobody appreciated him. I suppose every artist would. But part of this vision, I mean, it really is, it's such a radical individualism. He's doing it himself.
So
by using his imagination and reading the Bible and initiating the apocalypse for himself, I mean, part of the message is you can't do it for someone else. Mm-hmm. He can't do it for you. I mean, just in more traditional terms, I mean, no one can convert you to Christianity. I mean, that step of faith would be something you need to make yourself. Someone can sort of get you to the edge, and then you decide yourself whether to take the jump or not. And I think that's part of what he's up to. He's doing this art as much for himself as for anybody else. Because by doing this, it's the only way to fight the principalities and powers of darkness, which he also sees around him everywhere. And of all his works, this is perhaps his darkest, because, as I argue, it's a response to the book of Ecclesiastes. And just a quick comment on that. Book of Ecclesiastes is like Job, I mean, the lament of an experienced person in the world who's seen that God's justice just isn't working out. That God doesn't reward good people. God doesn't punish bad people, at least not that the speaker of Ecclesiastes can see. And all he can see is that life is this endless cycle of things that have happened before. So his constant refrain is vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It's really a despairing vision. So that Blake writes this somewhat in response to that. Anytime he's responding to the Bible, he's saying, I'd like you to read it this way, a little differently than perhaps you might have, and Blake will see different things in Ecclesiastes and you'll correct it to some extent. So, it helps to have, what I'm not going to do is just line out why this poem you've got in front of you is a response to the Ecclesiastes in a detailed argument, which is interesting to me, but I'm not sure it'd be terribly interesting to you. But what I want to do is just give you a quick dose of Blake's mythic view. And some of these weird characters that he invents and what he's doing with them, not because you necessarily want to know what the names of all these characters are, but he's telling a story, and he's telling it in a certain way, and ultimately it's the way he's telling it that's the point. The wrong way to even read Blake is to say, who's who, what do they do, what's their stories, the way you would read lots of novelists, you want to follow the characters and follow the story. To read Blake is very much like reading Joyce. So if you've read Joyce's...
Ooh, I had trouble with Joyce.
Yeah, so do I.
Martin, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Did Blake have visions or dreams that he wrote from, or...
He describes, just walking down the street and having visions. And sometimes it's just a self-initiated vision that an artist has, is to conceive things differently from other people. But, as a mystic, I think he was experiencing these things that were very real to him, and the way he writes about them, they're all extremely real. And all these characters that show up in his poems are real to him. And they're partly real because of just his method. By speaking about them, he makes them real. And constantly what he's trying to do is say, how do we understand, it's the basic questions of mythology. How do we understand God? How do we understand the fall? How do we understand redemption? And his is, it's a Christian view, but he's not telling the traditional Christian stories in the traditional Christian way. He's saying, let's remember that all those things themselves are metaphors. And his method for reminding himself that they're metaphors is to invent some new ones. And one of his central myths that he tells is the story that he's presenting in this most detailed fashion in this book, The Four Zoas. And what the title means is these four characters that have names. One of them is Urizen. One of them is Luva. And there's symbolic meaning and connection to some of these. One of them is Los. Los is his poet artist that he's sort of most self-identified with. Urizen is this sky god who's the embodiment of the Old Testament god who thinks he runs the show, but it's not really the right god, the right god for Blake. And it's like what Walt was talking about the Trinity at the Bible Sunday this morning. Did you hear him talking about that this morning? I mean, again, where Walt says you have to start with the gospel story of Jesus. That's where you start. That's where Blake starts. That's God. There's all kinds of other sort of ways to think about God, but really it's ultimately Jesus. So then what he's doing in this story is something like medieval morality plays where you have a good angel and a bad angel whispering in your ear, and one of them is telling you one thing, one of them is telling you another thing. And he's sort of taking that to extremes. And the connection to Ecclesiastes with that format is Ecclesiastes is spoken by this character named Colette, who means the assembler or assembly, and teacher. And he has built the city of Jerusalem, as he says, and got no satisfaction out of it. So he puts together these proverbs of experience. So what Blake does, he tells this story about these four Zoas, these sort of God things that talk in your ear, that are inside the body of Albion, which is Blake's name for every man, which also is also a name for England. So he's personifying England, his land, the place that he lives. And all these figures that he's talking about in this long drama are inside Albion's head. And Albion has fallen asleep. So throughout all this, here's this guy that fell asleep. And he's sleeping at the bottom of the universe. And this is, when you think about this in terms of myths, he's sleeping on this rock at the bottom of the universe, and he's dreaming. He's having this dream, and in his dream, these four Zoas, these characters that have these names, are arguing with each other and fighting with each other. And what happens at the end of this thing is Albion wakes up. When he wakes up, everything's, that's the apocalypse, and all this stuff that's happened while he's been asleep has had all these consequences, and it becomes the material world that we're living in. I mean, this material world is somehow the materialization of the dream of Albion. So when he wakes up, things get better. I mean, that's the apocalypse. And in particular, what happens is each one of these Zoas, I'm not even sure clear what exactly that means, but these characters, psychological forces, have a proper place in your body. And if they go to the wrong place, you're out of whack. So Jungians love Blake because you can translate Blake into Carl Jung's psychological archetypal terms very easily. But you don't need to. But the story it tells is kind of funny, and it's another myth. It's Urizen's place is in the head of Albion. And Luva's place is in the heart, so their character goes up and wants to take his spot because it's in the head where he's running the show. So she gets him drunk and says, I want to take your plow and plow the universe, which is what you get to do all the time. He says no, but she gets him drunk. So she takes over, or he, and she's this double gender, and then he falls down into her place, and then Albion gets sick and has this bad dream. So what ensues is this bad dream that's arranged in nine chapters that are called nights. So there's night one, this long 20-page mess. Night two, night three, all the way to night nine when the apocalypse comes. So it's this weird dream frame, all couched in this big myth that's being told. It's all this stuff that Blake's invented, but I mean, you can see very clearly he's responding to the book of Ecclesiastes throughout, and he's responding to the Gospels and the messages of Christianity, always asking you to see how this is somehow related. So that's the basic schema here. And what makes reading it and reading Blake like reading Joyce, with all the convolutions and involutions and you know you need an encyclopedia of someone telling you how to read it to make any sense of it.
Thank you.
Just sit down. I mean, so do I. I mean, I give up reading the four Zoas too. I mean, I've never sat down and read this whole thing.
No. All these voices and all these what you call psychological forces and everything, that's pretty common today. You got all shelves of books about things like that. But was Blake very unique in looking at that? Are other people looking at all these different forces that are...
What makes him unique is that he's doing Joycean techniques before Joyce, and I'll just explain that in a second, but also the psychological validity of his exploration still ring true today. So the dramas that he's playing out, and even in his small poems, you can read and say, I mean, that does make sense to me, and that helps me think about, I mean, whether they're theological issues, the nature of sin, nature of redemption, or personal issues such as abuse.
So he was clearly looking at human nature, and it wasn't just wild dreams.
Right.
He really could read.
Yeah, I mean, like we like to think of or romanticize artists that are in tune with all that. I mean, in some ways Blake wasn't, was able to speak in a different language about it than psychologists today or than philosophers of his own day. And he felt up to me it was a more humanizing vision that he was presenting than Lockean philosophy, which he felt sort of excluded all that was human about humans.
I don't know what Lockean philosophy is.
Yeah, well.
Some guy.
Yeah, John Locke.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of John Locke.
Anyway, what Blake does, though, with this is he throws all these characters at you, and we'll just get a little taste of it.
Last name of the guy.
We'll get a little taste of it just by looking at a couple of these pages that I reproduced of this long 60-page poem or 100-page. He throws out all these names, never tells you who's who, and all these people in here start making speeches, and you don't know who's talking half the time. And every once in a while, you can figure it out. But it's like a puzzle, like Joyce likes to write. You figure out who's speaking to whom, who are they, what do they stand for. But what Blake is constantly doing, he hates conventional authority of any kind, including conventions of narrative and drama, including any conventions that build up and patterns with his own works. So if something starts to pattern and build up even in his own work, so you start to figure things out, he'll mix it up just to keep you confused, following along, to keep you trying. So, I mean, all these four Zoas, I mean, this gets into Blakean weird sort of mythic vision. They each have this, when they fall, they split into two. So there's two of them, a male and a female. And they're always hanging around each other, looking, trying to get back with each other. So the thing opens with one of these Zoas named Tharmas running around looking for his emanation, his spiritual wife, Enion. And everybody has a different point of view of what's happened. And what emerges in this long poem is everybody's, I mean, this is what makes it kind of fun to read. Everybody's got a version, this story, why things are so messed up. Everyone's is different, but they're all telling the same story. You can see how they're connected. So there's this Luva stole Urizen's place in the head business. Man, and Tharmas is running around with a different version of why Enion has been split from him. And then in this big kaleidoscope, it all starts to make sense in a way that's even hard to explain. And I wouldn't even want to try. But by the end, you have this multi-dimensional sort of feeling about how this all works, and if it does work, what Blake is hoping is a poetic response. You're responding with more than just the logic of your head. It is this sort of, and it's more than just the five senses. You're dreaming dreams and seeing visions and sort of getting it in some sort of divine way.
People having all different stories of the same one, that's, well, I think like a family with several children. And each one of those children can tell the same family event completely different because they were.
Yeah, so I just Xeroxed a couple pages, three sheets of this. And what I want to do is just show and tell this poem. And rather than just explain this is this now, is just take a look at some different pieces of this. And I'll make just a few connections, and I think the best method always for reading Blake is just for anybody that sits down with it, just to say, what do I recognize here? How can I put this in a context for things that I do recognize? And does it make me think about anything? And if it makes you think about nothing, then I think I'd say, put it down and go look at something else. So, the title here, The Four Zoas, subtitle, The Torments of Love and Jealousy in the Death and Judgment of Albion, the Ancient Man. So there's that Albion guy who's taking a nap. By William Blake, 1797. So this is written, just for historical context. The French Revolution has been going on that Blake's really very interested in and sees that political revolution as one of the imagination too. He's witnessed the American Revolution that he's been very interested in. So that type of political revolution Blake ties into really a mental one, which is more his thing. So then you get this quote, Proverbs. Proverbs are always important in Blake, so here's one at the very beginning of the thing. Rest before labor. Hmm. So he's just got this quick proverb. Rest before labor. Before you work, take a rest. Now, everything in Blake, you can read, like, innocence and experience from two points of view, so you're never clear which is the right way to read it, and ultimately it's always more than one. But, I mean, rest before labor, that's what Alvin's doing. He's taking a nap. And that's bad, because he needs to wake up, because England is sick. The poor are being oppressed, the king is nuts, you've got all kinds of misery going on. If Albion would only wake up, I mean, if Jesus would only show up and save things, the world would be a better place. So resting before labor, you might think that's bad advice for Blake, but that's the advice, to some extent, of the book of Ecclesiastes. Colette in Ecclesiastes is saying, I did all these things. I built this city. I collected wisdom. I ran around. I worked like crazy. And the word prophet shows up in Ecclesiastes over and over and over again, as often it does in Star Trek New Generation. Anybody watch that? With the Ferengi and their rules of acquisition, they're all about prophet chaos I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and that's one of the key themes of Ecclesiastes. What profit it? What kind of profit can you get?
That kind of profit. P-R-O-F-I-T.
Yeah, profit. Money profit. Oh, what yeah. What kind of profit can you get if you by building things and saving things and getting more wives and his final conclusion is you can't build up excess profit. What you need to do is enjoy the things that God has given you. But I mean, you can't take it with you is part of the message there. And rest before labor seems to be one of the. I was talking with Hans yesterday. What's his last name? Sponder?
Spaltholz.
Spaltholz, who teaches Ecclesiastes, and he was saying something very similar, that he gets as the whole message of Ecclesiastes is rest before labor. It isn't quite the words he used, but it was actually very similar. And I can say that since he's not here to correct me. Anyway, so resting might be a good thing. In fact, so Albion's taking this nap, but while he's napping, he is laboring. All the stuff's going on inside his head, and this is where it gets kind of Joycean. These things inside his head get out. And by getting outside of his head, I mean they become part of the real world. So it's not just in his head. So then we get a quote from Ephesians. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. You recognize those lines? I mean, the principalities and powers lines, that gets quoted a lot. Now, so that's there, although Blake scratched it out, because this is an unfinished manuscript. He'd never decided how exactly he wanted to do it. So these things in these brackets are things that he scrubbed out, but you can still see them.
What language is that thing up above?
Greek. But I mean, part of Blake's connection here is we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, and against spiritual wickedness. You know, he's thinking, I mean, these things inside the head of his mythic figure are the personifications of principalities and powers, forces. And they're not either good guys or bad guys. They're all part of the stuff of life, depending on your point of view and depending on their organization, whether things are going to work to help celebrate life or to help keep things dead. So what I want to do then is just read through the first page of this to get a taste of it, and then I'll show you what Blake does with Proverbs when he gets to his Apocalypse. So it starts out, night the first, so this is chapter 1, and then with not much explanation, the song of the aged mother which shook the universe, shook the heavens with wrath, hearing the march of long resounding strong heroic verse marshaled in order for the day of intellectual battle. It's a song. I mean, it's like Homeric song. He's going to sing you an epic. So we've got an epic going, and it's of epic length. So that's part of what's going on here. Then you get some biblical quotes, and that's why I have you get the Bibles in front of you, because I want to take a look and see what you think about what he's doing here. He says, next to his quotes, which are what he says, Blake says, four mighty ones are in every man. A perfect unity cannot exist but from the universal brotherhood of Eden. So he's talking about his four Zoas. So this is one way to think about sort of human personality. And then he's got some biblical quotes there. So if you could grab your Bibles and look those up. And my question is, why is he quoting John 17 and John 1 at the beginning of the four Zoas? And I've got some thoughts about it, but what he's doing here, he doesn't give you John, he just gives you the reference. Presumably, since you know it, you could look it up, and then he's asking you to think about it, to do exactly what we're doing. Why is he saying these things?
17. What is it, chapter 17 he wants?
Yeah, see, I mean, he's John, Roman numerals, he's got the C chapter after the Roman numerals. Chapter 17, verse 21, 22, and 23. So, whoever's got it,
yep.
Read it.
17, verses 21. I have it.
Okay.
That they may all be one, even as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. The glory which thou hast given me, I have given to them, that they may be one even as we are one, I in them and thou in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved them even as thou hast loved me.
Okay, so there's Jesus talking there. Just to set the context, I mean, he's been talking to his apostles, and he's explaining what we're talking about to some extent at the Bible study this morning. Relationship of Jesus to the Father. How are we to understand, I mean, the Spirit isn't here, but I mean, what we're talking about is the Trinity. What is this business that Jesus is doing? What's the relationship between Jesus and God? And how are we to understand that relationship? So that's part of what he's saying here. And he's saying, I pray for these people, and also for those who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. So there's this emphasis on unity. Even as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee. So there's this explanation of that sort of mystery, what exactly that means. They may also be in us, so that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And then the glory which thou hast given me, so he's talking to God, the glory that God you've given me, I have given to them, the disciples and others who listen, that I have given them that they may be one even as we are one. I in them and thou in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved them even as thou hast loved me. So this vision of cosmic unity there, of God, God's Son, and the body of Christ, the disciples and others. Now, the other citation that he gives is John 1. What is this?
Does this mean John 1 or does it mean the first chapter?
Yeah, good question. Let me see what I wanted. I mean, that sounds like, I mean, is that 1 John?
Well, if you're...
No, it would have to be John.
That's John chapter 1, verse 14. That's what he's saying. So John chapter 1, verse 14. So find that and read that.
That's the word became flesh and dwelt among us.
Okay.
Right. Full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father.
So this is John's sort of cosmic intro where he's talking about, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. Stuff that I've been talking about in other days. And in verse 14 he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, and we have beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. And then it ends there. So what's that talking about? I mean, what's John talking about?
He's talking about Christ.
Yeah.
And the Word became Christ.
So the Word became
flesh on it.
Okay, so incarnation. The Word became flesh, and then, I mean, those two things go together. If you take that one first, God speaks, the Word becomes flesh. That's the performative utterance that God is able to speak with. When God talks, things happen. When God speaks words, Jesus shows up. And there's the mystery of the power of the word. In John 17, Jesus is saying, it's not over. This can continue. I'm going around talking and saying words. That word is the same word that God is, that I am. And by me speaking these words, things are continuing to happen, and what's happening is the world is becoming one. So one thing that Blake is that interests me that he's doing here, he's focusing on the power of speech, the power of a speech act, in which jargon term is the performative power of God to speak. In John chapter 1, the performative power of Jesus to speak. In John chapter 17, and Jesus in those lines is saying, and you will all be part of me, we'll all be one together. And part of the point seems to me then is, if we were all one in Jesus, he's setting up this line, God speaks, things happen, Jesus speaks, Jesus shows up. Jesus speaks, things happen, and disciples are all one. And the next step is, we speak, we continue to speak, things continue to happen, and that's the process that Blake is constantly focusing on. So it's not read the Hebrew scriptures and listen to what God said and follow them as law. And it's not just what Luther said. Listen to what Jesus said. Gospel overthrows, fulfills, brings this new vision that then we need to live under and institutionalize and make a new law. But remember what Luther's whole point about this was, the whole point of the Gospels is this freeing from law and this continual new vision. And the only way Blake can understand that is, the only way, and lots of theologians will write about this in the same fashion, including the ones that Dave Peterson's been reading up here last week. The only way to keep this new Gospel vision from becoming itself a new law is to continue the line of prophetic speech. So that's what Blake does. He'll make new speeches. And then I'll read this, and I'll make some more, and so we'll keep passing on this line of prophetic speech makers making prophetic speech, which has the power, because Jesus just said it did in chapter 17, our own speech has power, the power of God speaking, let there be, in Genesis. And if we could understand that, Blake thinks, you got it. And once you can realize that your speech has power, then you can both see that that's certainly true in a material sense. Judges speak, people running London speak, and you've got orphanages and the poor suffering, and all kinds of despicable results of that. And Blake is saying, start speaking a different kind of speech and just think what kind of a world we would have. And partly what he's thinking is, speak the right kind of words, like Albion, wake up, and you can initiate the apocalypse. Hmm. So, I'll point to one other place in here, which is a kind of a beautiful poem, and then we'll get back to couple of songs, Innocence and Experience. I'm on page 325. And it hardly even matters for where we are in the narrative, because I couldn't even tell you. Who could? I'm not sure who it was that was talking, and you can sort of figure it out. Anion, one of the female figure that Tharmas has been running around looking for. She's saying this, so it's the speech of a woman character, which is significant. And I'm on line 10 on page 325, and she sings this song of experience, quite similar to some of the songs of experience in Blake's earlier songs. And this one is right out of the biblical wisdom tradition, and almost right out of Job. It's a rewrite of some of the lines out of Job, and we could take a look, but I guess let's not look at Job. But just remember, Book of Proverbs it's set up with a mythic frame. Blake is always taking his authorization for this whole weird vision right out of the Bible. And sometimes he's grabbing things that traditional churches don't grab, especially the personification of Lady Wisdom in the Book of Proverbs. Blake says, wow, I like this. Most, the tradition goes way back, the wisdom books that develop Lady Wisdom a bit too much don't make it into the canon, and they're in the Apocrypha.
So she's talked about in the some of the Apocrypha?
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's developed, she speaks even more, and it develops the mythology of her as this kind of Mrs. God type figure. But in the Book of Proverbs, God creates, the first thing God creates is Lady Wisdom.
So you're saying that the people choosing the canon, all men decided they didn't want...
You could say, I mean, that's some of the consequences, probably.
They didn't feel it.
But it also, I mean, you can't have a Mrs. God running around in Jewish monotheistic faith. And that stuff, in terms of when that Lady Wisdom business was developed, was actually kind of late in terms of, I mean, it was around post-ex, and I'm not great on all these days, it was post-exilic, so after they'd been in Babylon, come back, and had been in contact with the Greeks a whole bunch. So it's a Greek influence on mythologization and female deities. And in the Book of Proverbs, I mean, it's fascinating how it functions. Lady Wisdom is who God created first, and she is the speech of God.
Right, so she's part of God. So it's not really that it's two gods.
That's right. I mean, it's not.
It's just part of God's...
So it's a way of thinking about God's speech and using multiple gender to think about that. So she speaks... In the Book of Proverbs, this wisdom of confidence. In the Book of Job and Ecclesiastes, you get this cynical experience. But some of the imagery here that Ennian, Blake's character, is using ties into that. So Book of Proverbs has Lady Wisdom singing songs, come in, come follow the proper way. Contrast with Dame Folly, who was this prostitute singing in the street to people saying, come over here, I've got the secrets of life. And she leads to death. So here's this song of experience that's being sung here by Ennian, this character, and all these characters are fallen. And she says, you know, and part of why I draw your attention to this is it's just beautiful. What is the price of experience? Do men buy it for a song, or wisdom for a dance in the street? No, it is bought with the price of all that a man hath, his house, his wife, his children. You can see the Job connections here. Job got experience, and it cost him everything. Wisdom is sold in the desolate market where none come to buy, and in the withered field where the farmer plows for bread in vain. It is an easy thing to triumph in the summer sun, and in the vintage, and to sing on the wagon loaded with corn. It is an easy thing to talk of patience to the afflicted, to speak the laws of prudence to the houseless wanderer. To listen to the hungry ravens cry in wintry season, when the red blood is filled with wine and with the marrow of lambs. It is an easy thing to laugh at wrathful elements, to hear the dog howl at the wintry door, the ox in the slaughterhouse moan, to see a god on every wind and a blessing on every blast, to hear sounds of love in the thunderstorm that destroys our enemy's house, to rejoice in the blight that covers his field, and the sickness that cuts off his children, while our olive and vine sing and laugh round our door, and our children bring fruits and flowers. Then the groan and the dolor are quite forgotten, and the slave grinding at the mill, and the captive in chains, and the poor in the prison, and the soldier in the field, when the shattered bone hath laid him groaning among the happier dead, it is an easy thing to rejoice in the tents of prosperity. Thus could I sing, and thus rejoice, but it is not so with me. And she goes on. So, I mean, partly it's kind of, I mean, you can see the connections of the wisdom tradition, Book of Proverbs imagery, Job plot, and Ecclesiastes. I mean, just to summarize, I mean, what did she just say?
Well, it's easy to be happy when you've got the house and the corn and the barn.
Yes.
And easy to say, this is lovely. and to talk about, well, if you're prudent, give your little speech to the homeless, because you've got your house.
Yeah. So it's easy to have faith and bless God when things are going your way. And then it's easy to use that to justify not helping the poor, because God must have decreed it to be that way. And she's saying, I could say that, but I won't. That's not what my experience tells me.
But I hear lots of people say that today. Yeah. Lots of people are so upset about the welfare system. And it's not
their
fault.
And more and more, yeah. I mean, you hear this.
It's rising, I mean, getting more popular to feel that way.
I mean, what interests me, I mean, when I sit down to read this stuff, is just, I mean, how Blake is mashing together the entire biblical wisdom tradition in that brief passage. So you get Book of Proverbs, you get Job. I mean, Job's friends are constantly saying to him, you must have sinned because you're being punished. You deserve it if you've sinned. He's saying, no, I didn't. And Ecclesiastes too, I mean, this jaded speaker saying, I don't believe the Book of Proverbs anymore. I mean, it isn't a good, happy world where people get rewarded. I mean, you get sort of all those things rolled into one, into this one unity that John was referring to in chapter 17, where everything is connected. It's all one in God's vision. And then here's the dark side of making connections. And she's, I don't want that type of unity that's forced on me from the powers that be. Blake is always thinking, I mean, that the powers that be, this will always happen. They'll institutionalize it the way they want it and keep it that way. So what you need to do is fight that. And one way to fight it is to continue to articulate prophetic speech, critiques of that. But where Blake ultimately ends up is, and why I think that he abandons this whole book, is if you have people running around lamenting too much and just saying proverbs of fallen wisdom like in Ecclesiastes, he runs into this problem with his own philosophy. If saying something makes it happen, then saying fallen wisdom won't ever make the world unfallen. And it just runs the risk of keeping it fallen, because you've got these people saying, talking God talk, even though they don't like it, but by continually saying it, will only keep things in this endless cycle of fallenness and despair. What's that for? I got 5 minutes, don't I? Until lunch.
No.
What time is it?
12:45.
Lunch is until
1,
right?
Yeah, so we're saying, because I do want to get back to that if you get
okay.
5 more minutes. Anyway, so what Blake finally does in chapter in night 9 of this thing, he has an apocalypse, and the Zoas all go back to the right spot, and the way that all happens is through people speaking proverbs. I mean, and I won't even show you this, but it's fascinating to me, because Blake is always zeroing in on proverbs. So the narrative's going along this confusing fashion. Somebody says this proverb, and sometimes it's not even connected to the plot at all, just someone says a proverb. Not a fallen one, but one of Blake's out of his infernal proverbs in the marriage, heaven, and hell, his list of response proverbs that he likes. So they'll say that, and all of a sudden, poof, Urizen's back where he belongs. Then it goes along, and he falls back, and is still a big mess. Someone says another proverb, and poof, someone else goes back to where they belong. And by the end, you get to the very end of this thing, and the war's not over, but, in fact, I mean, part of the point is the war continues, because once you get peace, it's not a state. It's an activity of peacemaking. So these figures are still running around, and everybody's articulating their version of what's happened and the way things should be. So nothing really has changed between the first part of this poem and the second, except the point of view somehow. And it is looking at it a little bit differently, and the apocalypse is initiated. So I'll just put up one quick pair of poems back to Blake's early works that aren't so convoluted and strange, but he really is saying the same thing. spot.
Well, it's kind of amazing to recognize something Blake's as you flip by.
Right.
Okay, the divine image. And I'll read it out of my book since the words are a little bit tough to spot. This is from Innocence. So he's got this poem called The Divine Image in Songs of Innocence. And it's always a point of view thing. He's asking you to read this from the point of view of innocence, recognizing that we can't because we're not innocent. We're as experienced as Enyan giving that lament. And when you read it from a fallen point of view, I mean, you can see other things in it, but then he'll pair it with a poem of experience, which you can read from a fallen point of view, but you can also read from a position of trying to be innocent again. And it's those two together, which somehow is the intellectual warfare that we need both. So, the divine image, let me read you this. My goal in life someday, I mean, sitting here listening to Walt this morning, is to be able to give a lecture or a talk and wrap up coherently, perfectly, exactly on the dot when you're supposed to. I mean, that was amazing to me. I'm never done when I'm done. The divine image. To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress. And to these virtues of delight, return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God, our Father dear. And mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, Christ, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress, prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form in heathen, Turk, or Jew. Where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too. And the design is very complicated. You just have this big shape, which looks like a big inverted S. And I've been lately writing, I don't know about this, Blake's titles fascinate me. The title of his poem is The Divine Image. That big S makes the divine images. And he's constantly doing it. So we don't even know what the title of his poems are. That's what I've been thinking about lately. And then his companion poem to that one is this, which is a bad slide, but you can still see the picture on the right. It's the one on the right. It's called The Human Abstract. So you see this difference? I mean, Jesus incarnate, God made flesh. Concrete thing, that's religion of innocence. Abstraction, Blake doesn't like logic abstraction. So here's an abstract version of this.
Well, how do you know this is connected with the one you just read?
Well, you listen, you'll know.
Mercy, pity, peace.
That's it. Some of it. Pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor. And mercy no more could be if all were as happy as we. And mutual fear brings peace till the selfish loves increase. Then cruelty knits a snare and spreads his baits with care. He sits down with holy fears and waters the ground with tears. Then humility takes its root underneath his foot. Soon spreads the dismal shade of mystery over his head, and the caterpillar and fly feed on the mystery, and it bears the fruit of deceit, ruddy and sweet to eat, and the raven his nest is made in its thickest shade. The gods of the earth and sea sought through nature to find this tree, but their search was all in vain. There grows one in the human brain. I mean, that poem is not transparently simple to understand either. But the picture is interesting. There's Urizen, one of Blake's Zoas, the sky god. and his hair is his long braids, and it's tying him down into the material world. So that, that God is the God who created the material world that the Bible tells a story of, but then falls in love with it so much, he's only identified with it and becomes a symbol of materialism. So that God is a created God, but if you institutionalize the Old Testament and say, this is the only way, Blake, that's one of Blake's visions of what happens.
That's what would happen to the world if you only had the God of judgment.
So you need Jesus. I mean, and this is the poem on the other side, and there's the child leading the God. That's the way it should be. And there's Jesus, and then as he's getting at the four Zoas, and the next step is us. So part of Blake's message is one I like, meaning saying, try this at home. Do it yourself. Be an evangelist. Speak God's wisdom and keep it focused on Jesus. Now, you could say that in a lot of ways, and we all sit in sermons and hear it in a lot of ways. And a lot of times when you hear it spoken in the same old way, you don't listen anymore. Blake is saying it in ways that isn't the same old way. And if it's too weird, no one will listen either. And yet, I think what he's hoping is that it will be new enough, it will make people think about these metaphors in a fresh way. And that's really what it's up to.
Are there Blake kind of people today?
You mean prophets? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can point to lots of them. I mean, I would go to political leaders. I mean, Nelson Mandela.
Okay.
People who are speaking out for the oppressed, or certainly in Latin America. They usually get bumped off fairly.
Yeah, they usually get killed.
When you teach your class at a public university,
yeah,
can you talk about Christ?
Oh, we talk about the stories.
Because Christ is at the heart of what Blake is talking about, and can you point that out?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the stories he's telling, certainly. And a lot of Montana kids are Christians. But, I mean, there I'm always very careful because, I mean, I wouldn't assume everybody is.
No. But you're not advocating anything anyway. You're just saying that Blake, at the center of Blake, was Jesus.
Right.
So what's wrong with that?
But at some session we were at, somebody was sitting here that said that they aren't even allowed to have a Bible in their library.
Who?
Some guy sitting right there in his school.
Public school?
I think his name is John. I think he's one of the presenters. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And they don't even allow him to have the book of literature. They don't, even looking at his literature, they don't allow it in the library.
That's hard to believe.
Yeah, I mean, that's terrible.
He teaches young, is it?
I don't know what he does. I think it was somebody who, I think somebody said his name was John. I'd have to look at the board, but then I thought somebody else said he was one of the presenters.
Mm-hmm.
Like a public university, you can teach Bible as a teacher.
Yeah.
It's a public, university. That's why I'm wondering if maybe he's in a high school age.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thanks for being my audience.